can hear my neighbor calling. I can't breathe. And now I'm in a struggle land. I can't leave. Calling out the violence of these racist police. Said we ain't gonna stop until our people are free. Said we ain't gonna stop until our people are free.
All right, thanks, and welcome to the episode 2 of the Ferguson Response Network podcast, a weekly podcast devoted to supporting citizens working to create lasting social change through sustained civil disobedience and civic action. I'm your host, at Leslie Mack, and I am lucky enough to be joined by a cadre of awesome people to talk about some great topics today. First is Angel Carter. Angel Carter has been a social justice activist for 6 years, focusing on equality for African Americans and women. She's been involved with Ferguson protests since August 13th. Angel, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing good. I'm so glad. I'm happy to talk to you. I can't wait to get into all this stuff with you, so I'm very excited. I'm also joined by Juliet Iacovino. Juliet is a graduate student at Washington University in St. Louis, where she is a PhD candidate in clinical psychology. She studies racial health disparities, and she's been living in St. Louis for 6 years. Hey, Juliet, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I have, actually, he was on the first podcast, so maybe he'll be here all the time if he wants to be. Ricky L. Hines II, who is a Los Angeles native, U.S. Navy veteran, avid Googler, blogger, founder of the Americans United Again movement, and host of the Americans United Again podcast. And he's also co-host of the AUA Hope podcast. Hey, Ricky, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, and thank you for having me on again. I always feel like I have, like, the least impressive resume.
No, I feel like that.
I feel like that. I'm like, oh.
No, everyone. See, the thing is, I never have to give my resume, so it's great. So.
Exactly.
You're worth having you.
That's right. It's exactly right. A little bit of housekeeping. You can find the Ferguson National Response podcast on iTunes and also on Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network. And you can also find us on our website, FergusonResponse.org. And of course, if you have any actions that you would like to add, or if you're looking for actions in your area, you can go to FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. How is everybody doing as we head into this final week of the year?
Pretty good.
The usual, jolly but stressed.
Jolly,
I think that's
right.
Yeah.
The holiday woes.
Yes, it's a lot of highs and woes. This has been pretty woeful as well.
Yeah. Right.
So I like to start off with a little bit of news, just talk about some things that did happen within the movement. And one kind of large thing that happened over the weekend was a very large scale, about 3,000 people involved in the die-in at the Mall of America Mall in Minneapolis. Were you guys aware of any of that? Have you heard anything about the stories coming out of there?
Well, I saw it on my feed, like on my Twitter and on my Facebook, and quite frankly, I was really impressed with the amount of people that showed up, and I even saw the message on the board where they were warning protesters to leave, so that was quite interesting. But I personally loved the die-in. It looked great to me.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Julia? Had you heard anything about it?
Yeah, I heard about it. I saw stuff on Twitter and read a few articles. But I always get really excited when people shut down shopping centers because, you know, we got to hit them. We have to hit the powers that be where it hurts. And it seems like it kind of scared them. So I think that was a good sign.
Mm. They're unfortunately easily scared. But yeah, I do.
Right.
Very, very easily. Doesn't take a lot, but just put three black people in a square and you're done. They're very scared. Ricky, how about you?
Not even
you?
Three, though. They might be overdoing it.
Yeah, it might be.
That is true.
We had Actually, we had like two people shut down the Galleria sometime in like August or September, and they weren't even chanting. They literally just like walked into the bread company or something like that, and suddenly there were police all over the place. So it doesn't even take three.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. And did you hear about it in LA, Ricky?
I did, but I was actually a little preoccupied. I was doing some research and some reading, so I kind of saw it in passing, but wasn't really able to discuss it.
And I know you were on the Penniman Doctrine last week too, so you've been really busy.
Yeah, I've been incredibly busy. As a matter of fact, I think that's what I was studying for.
I can imagine. I've only gotten halfway through the episode, but I was like, "Oh, Ricky's on there!" I was excited. We had so much fun on that show with you guys. So, anyways. Yeah, well, a few things that I found interesting about the Mall of America Dying. One is I had been in some contact with the two organizers of it, and they had been getting serious pressure to cancel it. More than I had seen of any action thus far that's come across my purview over the last couple of months. You know, direct contact with them from the mall and really pressuring them to not do anything, you know, threats, everybody's going to be arrested, it's private property, and to their credit, they really saw that as a reason to continue, and yeah. I'm really impressed with them, and that the fact that they, you know, pushed and really kind of were very open and transparent with people, which I think is a real hallmark of the movement itself, is that, you know, these are ordinary citizens organizing these actions. It's not any large entities or even large not-for-profit entities. It's really individual people that feel moved to do something and then they act. So there's a lot of strength and power in that, and you're able to be transparent with people that want to interact with you and with the action that you're planning. And it really gives, I think that's why, to me, the turnout was as large as it was, because they tried to hold them back. And it's something I don't understand why, not to call them the opposition, but those that oppose the movement don't realize that everything they do only creates more of us. It's baffling to me. They haven't looked at the numbers and realized that every time they do something completely overreacting and inappropriate, it just goes to prove our point.
Right.
It's not baffling to me. I don't think a lot of these people who, you know, are so against what's going on are very intelligent.
Or in touch, I think.
And the other thing is, we live in an age where you can now turn to a news station and not just get a completely different opinion on the facts, but get completely different facts. And it's really dangerous, because they don't care. They just use the images as propaganda. Look what happened in D.C. where they prematurely cut part of the protest speech out and looped it.
To make
it sound like they were saying kill cops, and it was like, wait, no, that's not what it was. That's not what happened.
That's what we said.
Yeah.
Well, I think the problem with that is that even if, like, you know, that station in Baltimore or wherever it was, they came back and apologized, but even if you come back and apologize, it's still, once it's out there, people are going to believe it no matter what.
Yeah, and
I know.
The reason why it even got to the point was it was the person that they actually accused of saying this is the one that came and pushed back on them. And it happened to be somebody from that area. If not, I mean, really, let's say it was a protester in D.C. that was from, you know, California or New York City, and they wouldn't have seen this local news program, they may not have known that this was being said about them and that this was being done. And also, they just didn't really, the damage was already done, in that I've seen this thing quoted so many times prior to them retracting whatever they had to retract and having this woman come on to the show and explain her, you know, her side and why she was upset and what had happened in reality. So, yeah, the damage was already done, but I do think it goes to show you, certainly those of us that have been clued in, and maybe some people that were a little less than believing in terms of the media bias might be seeing things a little differently when it's such a transparent usage or abuse of, I guess, their powers, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
And I think the biggest reason that tactics like that work, where you can just put out a false story and retract it, is because not very many people read the news as often or follow the news as often as they used to. People who consider themselves high volume listeners listen as often as about 2 hours a day. People who consider themselves medium and low volume, that's 15 minutes and 2 minutes respectively. So, you know, if you see something like that, and then the next day you're not tuned in, or right. You know, for a couple of days, you don't know, and that's what they count on. That's how you fear monger.
Yes.
I mean, you got to admit that it's pretty good. It's damn good strategy, even though it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I just want to interject and really let's discuss these damages that happen when the media present a biased story or when they show like only partial information to make it look one way when it's not. As a protester, for us, like from on the outside looking in, I know a lot of people look at the situation and think, oh, well, you know, they presented a lie. They're just trying to, you know, fear monger and all of that. But as a protester, when news outlets make that kind of decision, it puts us in danger.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, absolutely. You know, there have been so many headlines, or sometimes they will take a headline about violence that has nothing to do with protesters, but will put the picture of the protesters underneath the headlines. You know what I mean? Like, we see all of these different tactics of fear-mongering, and a lot of times what happens is we get citizens here in St. Louis that want to respond to us in a violent way. And so right. My issue with that is like, oh, yeah, like it's great. Like, yeah, put that lie out there. Yeah, fear-mongering. You know what I mean? I know a lot of people are totally for it, or some people look at it and say, you know what, that's not right. That's not okay. But on a deeper level, that actually puts my life in danger.
Yep.
And so,
yeah, absolutely.
And I actually read this this court case, like in 2005, I believe, where there are certain news outlets that are allowed to lie. And that for me is frustrating, because we can't even hold these news outlets accountable for when they put our lives in danger like that. Like, as a citizen, I feel completely helpless. How do I hold you responsible for this lie that I'm violent?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I, Ricky, what were you saying? I know that there's a whole thing, when Fox, News applied for its license, the way that they did it, or the reason why they did it when they did, was because the law making it a rule that you had to be truthful if you were presenting news, to the public was lifted.
Originally it was
Reagan,
called the Fairness Doctrine, and
right.
It was relaxed in, I think, 85 or 86
by Ronald Reagan. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Reagan.
And then it really hadn't been enforced
right.
at all. And so I think in 2005, I forgot exactly what happened. Usually pretty good with stuff off the top of my head, but not this time.
That's okay, but anyway, yeah, they basically
the way that it ends up is that they're not required to even be honest,
right? But while pushing a tagline of fair and balanced, which right. I find completely yeah. ironic, you fight to not have to be truthful, but that's what you claim to be doing. Which actually is a good segue to the other large story, just in the country. I wouldn't say within the movement, more the reaction to it was the bigger topic in the movement, which was the killing of two New York City police officers over the weekend. I don't really want to talk about the case itself because I don't think it has much bearing in its details with regard to the movement, but I did want to talk a little bit about the reaction to the killings and its effect on the movement as a whole, on people on a personal level, and kind of where you think the reaction went right and went wrong in terms of within the movement and what you guys saw. Ricky, why don't we start with you?
Okay. As far as the way that it affected protesters, I know that there has to be a feeling of just anger towards the guy because he's in effect putting protesters' lives in danger. The NYPD isn't the nicest police department around, and while they've done a fairly good job of protecting protesters during the mass protests, this didn't help at all. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people have made the argument that this is inconsequential as far as we're concerned. It's sad to see those two officers go, but just like the way that people die, that cops shoot unarmed black people primarily or disproportionately, there's going to be a crazy person that's not going to take too kindly to that. There are crazy people on all sides. So these are kind of the things to be expected because this is a long-term goal. Mm-hmm. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if, we had another police killing in the next, before the end of the year.
Well, because
this is going to continue.
There actually was a police officer killed in Florida just two days after the incident in New York City. A white person was the killer in this case. And so apparently it doesn't fit anything. So nobody's going to talk about that.
Right.
So that's why I say that, like, details of the case really don't matter because it's not really what the story is, and it's not the story that the media is even trying to latch on to. Because if they were, they'd be talking about lots of other things, like how our criminal justice system treats mentally ill individuals, like interstate communication with regard to potential endangerment of citizens, like the fact that there was a social media component to this. None of which have anything to do with what's being talked about with regard to the case at all. So,
It's not like these were the first cops that have gotten killed by someone even since August. Right. So,
absolutely. So Juliet, why don't you tell me a little bit about kind of what you were thinking and seeing, you know, since this weekend?
Yeah. I mean, I think protesters, people in the movement, I think from what I've seen, like on Twitter and stuff, handled it fine. I mean, I think people are giving their condolences and explaining, like, the movement's nonviolent is the focus of it, so there'd be no reason for anybody to condone the killing of anyone. I don't really watch, like, TV news or anything like that, but I do wish, I had seen a little bit while I've been at home with my parents because they have cable, but I do wish there had been more of a voice given to people in the movement to kind of respond. But I might have just missed that. But I also think, like, one thing that's really striking to me is that nobody's talking about the woman that he tried to kill before he even made it to New York.
Because she doesn't fit the narrative. Yeah. So why would they mention her?
Exactly.
Yeah, right. True.
But, you know, she's been completely left out of the story. Yeah. And, you know, it just goes, I mean, I'm not surprised by any of the reaction whatsoever. I mean, and this is when, you know, when like I was talking to my mom today about, you know, respectability politics and stuff like that. I'm like, it really doesn't matter what protesters do. Like, the media and the police and the powers that be are going to find something to try and discredit the movement, whatever it is, whether it's something that just happens or whether they, you know, instigate it, whatever. So,
right.
You know, I feel like people aren't getting too caught up in the narrative that people are trying to push.
Right, which I always find interesting, especially when I see older, you know, white Americans coming at the movement in this specific way. I feel like you're old, though, right? You were here for the last civil rights movement, and these are all the same things that your parents said about the freedom riders, about the sit-ins at lunch counters,
right.
All of these things. It's like the same rhetoric, the same. It's like history repeating itself on that side, and I don't understand it. I'm buoyed by the fact that on this side, we're not repeating the same tactics and we're not going about doing this work in the same way. But it is astounding to me to see the same. It's like carbon copy. I see so many pictures. Somebody will make a photo from Ferguson or from Staten Island or from Berkeley or tonight from Milwaukee and just make it black and white and ask what year it is. And you really, honest to goodness, can't tell if it's 1967 or 2014. So it's just kind of a weird place that we're in with regard to that sort of thing. Angel, what were your thoughts on the response and kind of if it's having any significant ripples within the movement?
Honestly, I have very mixed feelings about the response simply because there was such a variety of reaction, some of which were completely illogical to me. Mm. So, like, on one side, you have the media reaction. And from my perspective, I felt like the media is, like, really trying to sell this story of cops are in danger, people are killing cops, because there was, like, this saturation of these cops are being shot. But then when you look at the data on cop killings versus, like, who police officers kill, you find out that 27 of these murders happen per year.
Yeah.
On police officers.
And that was just 2013. It's actually less this year, so.
It's 13. Okay, so it's 13 in 2014 versus the 400 to 1,000 citizens killed by police officers.
That we know of. That we know of, because a lot of those statistics don't even count people that are killed in custody, that die while in custody. So that's just what we know of for sure.
Exactly. Yes. And it's the fact that this number, this 13 for 2014, as you stated, the fact that we have to express that amount in a range, we have to say from 400 to 1,000, that shows that we are really in trouble. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need to have a very specific number about how many are killed exactly. And then in addition to that, we don't know if they were armed or unarmed. We don't know what happened. We don't know if investigations were done with integrity. We really don't know. And so this media response, like trying to sell this story of police officers are just being killed left and right, that was completely irresponsible to me. And I felt like that was a way to try to devalue the movement in a way, to try to like sell this story of this movement isn't necessary. And then in addition to that, I don't like the way some of these headlines are worded. It's a lot of you have people that are anti-police. Well, first of all, I'm not anti-police, and I know it's a lot of other people that are protesting. They are not anti-police. They are anti-police brutality. Right. And so that's another issue. You have people thinking, well, we are anti these people in badges. No, that's not the issue. The issue is the accountability, the responsibility, and the integrity. That's what we're wanting in these people that wear these badges. But then in addition to that, I was kind of proud of the people in the movement because I didn't see a lot of people mocking this murder.
No.
I saw a lot of people express remorse, and that includes the families of these victims.
All of them.
That to me was a beautiful thing. And that really, and I think that really, that showed a lot on our part. Like, because on our part, you have us showing remorse, and we're like, you know what, prayers, you know, we send our best to the family, you know what I mean? But then on the other end, you have some police officers that will say something like, well, I would do it again. You know what I mean? And I think that really shows the contrast in like, who is valuing the human life here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had posted on Facebook, you know, because I had all sorts of horrible trolls once this happened. And I said on Facebook something like, if you are coming to ask me what my thoughts are on the killings of the police officers in New York, don't. Because I fight every day to end violence. It's all that I do, from the when I get up to when I go to bed. So obviously you know what my stand, how I feel about it. I personally was like, obviously the media, ridiculous. Obviously the police unions, ridiculous, and the benevolent associations. I don't even know what to say about that.
Yeah, I was like, you can't even talk about it because
it's surreal. It's like so, it's the craziest shit I've ever heard in my entire life. I've just never even imagined it. Even seeing what happened in Ferguson and knowing that that's literally the possibility in any community in this country, because that's really, to me, it's what moved everyone about Ferguson and why we all decided to support the work that's been going on there for this months on end that everybody there has been fighting so hard, is because we recognize that what you were doing, if we decided to do those very simple things, the same thing would happen to all of us. And so this illustrated that really well, I think, not just to us, but to those that might have thought it wouldn't happen here. It's like, no, because when the largest police union in the country says that they're at war, what do you think that that means? Who are they at war with exactly?
Yeah, and the guy, you know, he's the guy who committed these murders. He's no longer with us. So who are you at war with?
Exactly.
Really?
Right.
What justice are you seeking exactly? I'll say that I thought about putting something about, you know, condolences and that sort of thing onto the Ferguson Response Tumblr. But then I actually, after thinking about it and kind of sitting with it for a little bit, I decided not to, because I felt like it would give it a little bit too much space within the movement. And I also have a problem with this expectation of, you know, Eric Garner's daughter went to Erica. She went to the site and she put a wreath down and she had some words for the family. She really wanted to support them. And I thought to myself, you know, did a single police officer go to her father's funeral? Were they thinking about him? No. They think it's all right that he's dead. And here she is extending herself. And I just had this thought of, you know, I'm not really going to give them that space. And it's why I didn't want to talk about the specifics of the killing. So I don't really think that it has a place in a discussion within the movement. I do think it's really important that we stay focused on what our task is, because this had nothing to do with it. So it shouldn't derail that. And I love quite a few large organizations just coming out, Ferguson Action being one of them. You know, we will not be silenced. And I love that New York right now, as we're taping this on Tuesday night, there are two huge actions going on, one in the Bronx and one shutting down Fifth Avenue, which is the hugest shopping area in New York City today. So I love that those things continued, and we have other actions going on. Milwaukee is having a huge action right now. So I'm really buoyed. I was really concerned that people would not go through and hold these things, especially when these politicians are on TV asking for time for whatever. And I was like, what are you talking about? This doesn't have anything to do with us, and our actions didn't contribute to it. So why are we stop fighting for the things that we believe in? It doesn't even have any relation to each other whatsoever.
No, and the one thing that I hoped when I first heard about it is that maybe the NYPD would learn a lesson about antagonizing people. Mm. And what I mean by that is the I can breathe shirts.
Yep.
Like what rapper was that went on Twitter and said it was the Game.
It was the Game. Damn, yeah, the Game. I saw that.
Damn Compton guys.
Those damn California rappers.
He said something to the effect that, can you breathe now? And I'm sure everybody in the back of their mind who had any awareness that both of those things was going on was like, kind of had that thought too, because it's like, you can't, people are crazy. There are crazy people of every race, creed, color, gender, whatever. You can't antagonize people and think that that's going to be okay. You can't just antagonize people. You can't, you know, people are in the streets protesting the death of an unarmed man using a banned technique. And the thing that you find it okay to do is to not only wear the shirts, but wear them publicly.
Mm-hmm.
In uniform. Like that's a slap in the face to not just the people protesting, but to taxpayers.
It goes back to the irony of saying that being anti-police brutality is anti-police, yet here they are. They're not pro-police. They're anti. They're using this man's last dying words.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that is antagonistic. That is something that is anti somebody else. And it's just ridiculous.
Well, and then people sit and say, like, oh, the protest brought this on. You guys, you know, go home, don't protest, you're antagonizing people. And it's like, really? Why are we protesting? It's not because we just feel like it. Right. It's because there's something going on. And for them to even connect this to the protest, I mean, obviously, it's just egregious what the media is doing about this and what the police are doing. But, you know, at the same time, it's like, you know, the police in New York and all over the country routinely harass Black people. So why are you surprised that somebody would take some of their anger out on the police? I mean, it has nothing to do with protests. It's in a way sprung out of the same thing that the protests sprang out of.
And I'm not even convinced of that.
Frustration with the system.
I'm not even convinced of that. Almost every mass shooting that happens in this country starts with domestic violence. And this is no different. This one started the same way as well. You know, we have a gun control problem in this country. That is in play here. We have a mental health issue and crisis, actually, in this country where it's not addressed in communities, certainly not of communities of color because of economic pressures and also health care disparities. So you add to that someone that's been in the criminal justice system and forget it. There's zero help in that area for that. So there's so many things at play. I'm not even convinced that that the protests or even the atmosphere around them would necessarily contributed to this. It may have been a factor because it's what people are talking about, certainly, but I don't even know if you could even say that. We'll never know, obviously. And to me, it's like, okay, it's a tragedy. Two people were killed. Nobody wants to see that. The person killed themselves. I don't know why there's even additional discussion.
Yeah.
Right.
Seems to me that this is like, let these families have their time to themselves versus you're politicizing them. You want to accuse Black people, leaders, people in the movement of trying to politicize things and make things about race when it's not. And that's what they're doing.
Well, yeah, literally, I mean, complete hypocrisy. Literally, I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's, you know, what's that hashtag, Ricky? It's okay when you do it, though.
Yeah,
this is exactly. This is exactly it.
We're going to get that started for John one of these days.
It's true, because this is another one of those situations where it's like, oh, okay, you can make it about race. And it's not racist, but we say anything that has to do with race, with numbers and facts and anecdotal evidence and actual data, and we're the racists. Okay, got it. Just making sure I'm clear on how this is working, because it doesn't really compute at all.
And not just that, but look how low the bar is set for what they consider antagonization or race baiting. Simply talking about something being racist is seen as race baiting. Yeah. It's seen as bringing race into a discussion that didn't need to be done. And it's like, wait, what?
What are you talking about?
It's black people are so disproportionately shot by police that it's a problem. If it were happening at the same rate where whites were being disproportionately killed, from what we know, about 12% more than their representation of the population, there'd be fucking riots. Police brutality would be solved in 4 to 5 months max.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's true. It's true. Absolutely. Yeah. Angel, did you have anything to add?
No, I think you guys covered it.
Okay, awesome. I just like to make sure everyone gets a moment. So I just wanted to touch really quickly on upcoming actions. As I mentioned, there's quite a few actions going on today, which is Tuesday. And then I think there's one tomorrow, one on Friday, and then Saturday the 27th. Quite a lot of action is going on. And if you want to take a look at that, you can. I know there's a big LA Millions March LA is happening that day at 2 o'clock. They just announced the location, and you can find all this information on FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. And then the other thing, the song that I played at the top of the show is actually part of the RTD challenge, or the I Can't Breathe challenge, and that was by Songbird Lynn _04. That was her rendition of the I Can't Breathe protest song. And I don't know if any of you on the call have done the challenge yet. I have tasked my 15-year-old niece, who is in a performing arts school, to produce our entire family doing it over the holidays. So mine will be up soon. So I don't know if any of you have done it, but it's been really cool seeing people's different renditions of it. I've seen bands and rappers and all sorts of people. It's been pretty cool.
I've done it. I had to delete that file because it was a...
You too? Okay. All right. At least I know I wasn't the only self-conscious one.
Oh, okay. All right. I saw someone said they were going to sign, do it in sign language. Like, my voice sucks, but I know sign language, so I'm going to sign it. I was like, oh, that's cool.
Oh, I love that. That's a great idea.
That seems like it would take a while, though.
Maybe. I think there's like a lot of shorthands you can do with sign language, like for words, versus you have to spell everything out, so it's not as long.
True.
Yeah. Okay, so the next topic I wanted to cover was talking a little bit about how you guys have seen, or how you think you see these protests moving into action, agenda building, communication and community organization building, that sort of thing. Have you guys seen any of that stuff happening in your areas or nationally? And what are your thoughts on how that is shaping up, and also how different this is from previous movements that we've seen, and why it's so different?
Yeah, I mean, so I think there's a big transition going on in St. Louis right now. So I think people are, one, trying to broaden the message. So, you know, what sort of problems do we focus on? Let's expand it from police brutality and go to other things that, you know, other forms of racial injustice. Mm-hmm. And then also, like, how do we get that message across, and what are some of the tactics that we're going to use to get our demands met? So going from just protests and marches to, you know, organizing and other ways for doing it. And then I think there's also some... So in St. Louis, we have a lot of different organizations that kind of sprung up after Mike Brown was murdered, and so there are a lot of people doing a lot of different things. But we have, you know, regular meet, like we'll have big mass meetings that just have a lot of people at them to kind of let the community know what's going on. I think they're going to start having people's assemblies where the community can come and speak. And then there's smaller meetings with organizers who are from a bunch of different organizations to just get together and talk about, you know, what actions are coming up or what kind of organizing is going on. And so I think people are going to start thinking about focusing on like organizing, education, and community empowerment, building alternative systems and structures in the community so that we can sort of be more self-reliant. So I know that Ferguson Action has made like a list of demands and they got input from the community and I think they revised them this past weekend. They presented that. And so those demands are more broad and encompass, I mean, everything you could think of when you think of the criminal justice system and other systems that are racist. And there's like going to be a fellowship for organizers in the area in terms of like teaching them organizing skills and life skills and how to balance it, things like that. So there's a lot going on right now and there's a big transition and, you know, we're kind of figuring out what kinds of, you know, different tactics we can use and, getting better at becoming organizers rather than just protesters and things like that. So it's really exciting in my opinion. I'm really looking forward to see what people start to focus on, some of the other tactics people are going to come up with and just, you know, trying to get our community back on track as much as we can. Well, back on track, I'll say on track in general, because, you know, we've been dealing with this shit for a long time. Yeah. So, right.
And Angel, I know you're in the area there as well. So have you been seeing the same things and what have you been personally kind of experiencing having been in this for so long?
Yeah, kind of the same things. A lot of, you know, meetings, a lot of groups are developing, you know, we have commissions. But to kind of add on that, I would say what benefits this movement as well as separates it from like past movements we've seen before would have to be it's so decentralized. And I think that's a very powerful thing for us. Mm-hmm. And again, like I'm speaking from my perspective. I wasn't involved in like the civil rights. Like I wasn't even born. But when I look at, you know, what happened in the book versus what I see now, to say that this is a leaderless movement, I think it's part of the reason why it's so powerful, because now you have everyday citizens taking responsibility of making change versus a lot of people coming together and kind of waiting on someone else and putting all of this weight on one person's shoulders or a couple people's shoulders or like this one organization. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
and so
definitely.
I think that's been very effective in growing the movement. Also, for me, I think that is a great like safety tactic. To mm-hmm. not point someone out as like, yes, this is the ultimate leaders. Because when you look at those history books, we see what happens to leaders that try to make change.
Yep.
And once they're gone, exactly. Once they're gone, because they were the inspiration, once they're gone, the movement is gone. Well, this time around, even if something were to happen to someone that is fairly substantial, this movement can still live. I hope that's making sense.
No, definitely.
The movement can still live.
Absolutely.
And,
No, it's absolutely right. Agree. Completely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And in addition to that, I think, like, technology has been an incredible tool, from having newsletters to blogs to podcasts to Twitters and Facebooks, like all of that. What I love about those tools is like, even if I'm not in another city, like I'm not in Cleveland, Ohio right now, but I still know exactly what's going on with the people in Cleveland, Ohio. And in addition to that, I would even say these crowdfunding sites have also been very powerful, kind of go into like that self-sustaining deal. Because now we have leaders from Ferguson that are able to go to different parts of the country. And for me, and I personally have never been one of the ones to go like to New York or Ohio or anything like that. But I think that's powerful because you get the people that were kind of like at the heart of the movement, the start of the movement, to take that energy to the other city and connect with those people. Because what's happening is, you know, you get the, once again, you have these unjustified murders. And so instead of people in these other cities and these other states, like, kind of going through the figure out phase that we had to go through for the first couple months, we can just already go with experience. Hey, you need this, you need this, you need this. You know what I mean? So that even helps other cities and other states move a lot quicker in the movement. And so I think those were, like, the main things that really separated and really make it powerful.
Absolutely. I agree with everything that you guys just said. I would say here in Philadelphia, we've been doing a lot of the same things. We've had two large town meetings, town hall meetings in Philadelphia. The first one had like 400 people. We had 500 at the last one. Our next one's just after the new year. It's been incredibly empowering. We've been able to have some time for people to kind of say things to the group. And then we've been breaking into small breakout groups to talk about things, all sorts of things, education policies, legal support, setting up infrastructure so that we're able to sustain this movement here locally for a long time. And it's been really great to see so many young people coming together with, at least here locally, the faith community. And we have a group called Power here that is a group of faith leaders in the area. And they've been so incredibly supportive between providing spaces for people to meet and just really supporting everything that the young people want to do. They're very cognizant as older people that this is something that the youth needs to lead and that they need to be able to support the actions that are going on. And it's been really great to see. And a lot of that are lessons that we saw in Ferguson being learned in real time. And because of all the technology that Angel just mentioned, we were able to really see it, not read about it, but to see in real time how people reacted to things, what things worked, what things didn't work, and kind of take those lessons and move forward from them. I completely agree about the decentralized thing. I think it's one of the hallmarks of the movement, and I think it's what is probably scaring the powers that be the most, because it's you know, one of those things. It's like you know, Hydra from the what's that show?
G.I. Agents of Joe?
No, not Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Are we talking about G.I. Joe here?
No, from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Marvel Universe, they have Hydra, and it's like cut one head off and another one grows in its place or whatever.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, yeah. Oh, never mind. Yeah. Same difference.
Same thing, same idea. I went to G.I. Joe too, like, wait a minute.
Yeah, so that I think is really great, but I always like to push back a little bit on this idea of a leaderless, because I don't think that the movement is leaderless. I think it's the opposite. It's leaderful. We're all leaders. Yeah. You know, we're all called to lead in whatever way that might be, and it might be somebody having a podcast, or it might be somebody organizing donations for something. It might be whatever area that you see that your role is. And I think the mantra for me that people always ask me, what can I do? And I said, well, if you have an idea, do it. That's really what I found to be the biggest strength, is this empowerment of people. Duray tweeted something the other day, and it was so profound to me. He said that what Ferguson did was give people the permission to protest.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
This is what was missing. It's like, yes, we all been feeling these things. We all had these same thoughts. We all been so frustrated by the mass incarceration of our people and the prison industrial complex and all of these things and police brutality and, you know, the economic status of people of color in this country. But we didn't know what do you do with that energy? What do you do with that? And Ferguson was like a beacon, like, oh, we can do that. We can all do that. And so it's been great to see so many other cities and parts of the country pick up that mantle and say, yes, we can do this too. And it's been really uniting. But at the same time, they don't know where to go to put them all out, because there isn't one place to go. And that's where I feel like that decentralized nature of it. It's not that you can put one organization down and so therefore all the cities will stop doing what they're doing. It doesn't work that way. And we all have local issues. And, you know, it's shame on them for not seeing how, or not thinking we don't realize how pervasive this problem is, because everybody has a Mike Brown and everybody has an Eric Garner and everybody has a Tamir Rice and a Kai Gurley and Renisha McBride and it goes on and on, because we just had one here last week, Brandon Tate Brown. You know, it's a disturbing and disgusting every 28 hours. It's like fucking clockwork.
Yeah.
Clockwork.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ricky, what are your thoughts on all of this transitional time in the movement?
This would be a wish list. Everything that's been done to this point has been absolutely amazing, considering that this just sprung up like 4 months ago. But I'm hoping and I'm praying that at some point this leads to some sort of political arm or political movement, because there's no way that Jay Nixon shouldn't be primaried in Missouri in 2016. Given the fact that so few people actually show up to a primary, that if you galvanize enough people, he'd be done. He'd be done in a Democratic primary, and he'd pay for his mistakes, because ultimately he has been pulling the strings in the state of Missouri with respect to what's taking place in Ferguson and in St. Louis County in general. You can blame Bob McCullough, but Bob McCullough has to answer to someone. You know, Bob McCullough didn't call a state of emergency. There are ways that we can help ourselves in protesting and having better relations with those who are in power in our government. Mm-hmm. It's unavoidable. The reason why they pander to racists, because you know why racists go out and vote. Yep. Quite honestly,
yep.
If Jay Nixon thought that he would have lost his job by calling a state of emergency in the state of Missouri, there would have been no way in hell he'd do it. He's a politician. That's the one thing that remains supreme, is that he wants to keep his job or go for a better job.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're seeing that right now in New York with de Blasio.
Yeah.
You know, just people's reaction to him.
He's handled this about as well as you can.
I don't know how much better he could handle it, but you see, he speaks out as the father of a black son, and he's treated like a black person. That's what has occurred in New York. It's really profound to see this white man being treated like this, just because he came out and spoke from his heart about his black son that has to deal with the realities of the world today. And it's kind of crazy to see that. I think I read a poll that came out today that 2/3 of white New Yorkers are giving him a, you know, disfavorable rating as mayor.
Oh my God.
2/3.
He has other issues too, but I mean, even when you look at like charter schools and whatnot, but
sure,
that's one of the most you have a really high minority population in the city of New York. Mm-hmm. So while it affects them, it doesn't affect them as much. And if people go to bat for people who at least are trying to do the right thing, I don't think there's really any way that de Blasio could have walked this line any finer. Go to bat for that, because he's more apt to do it again, and he's more apt to come stronger.
Yeah. And I hope that that's what he sees, and that that's what everyone else sees. You know, obviously, the other thing that people don't take into account is that I'm from New York City. I grew up there. And from my recollection, there's never been a mayor that hasn't been completely at odds with the police chief and the police union.
Right.
In my entire time on this earth, I've never heard of that happening. So this is not a new phenomenon. You know, they want to do what they want to do, and they don't want anybody telling them otherwise. This extends to mayors as well. So. That making it about what he said about this is ridiculous, because whatever he's going to say, they're not going to be happy with it. I will say it's been kind of crazy to see the GOP and Fox News and everybody on the side of the unions. What the fuck is going on exactly? It's kind of freaking crazy.
It's just complete contradiction.
It's like, what is, it's like the Twilight Zone. Oh, wait. It's bad for black people. We like it. I mean, that's literally what it feels like, because I don't know what else to think other than that. There's no other way to take it except for that way.
Yeah. And you know what else? Well, and I'm glad that you... I'm sorry. Keep going.
Oh, no. The thing about... I hate and I despise Fox News. Not because... Well, because of what they do. Their tactics are fucking amazing from a framing and media standpoint. Ugh. And I like as a tactician, it is unrivaled. The Tea Party, I would say, been able to take, you know, the entire Republican Party hostage with just a few members.
Yep.
And I can't help but admire their their tactics, because they're very well executed, they're very well planned out, and this is, they realized about 60, 70 years ago that this was going to be a long game, and they're at a point where it's reached its height.
Yep.
And so they're at a point where they're really just trying to hold the ball until the clock runs out.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that contradicts the narrative that they need to remain in business and to remain profitable and to keep the people happy, or keep people who they need to be happy, happy, they'll do it. They're completely amoral.
They are. This has been a problem for liberals for a while, though, Ricky, as you know. I mean, it's one of those things that our liberalness, shall we say, has gotten in the way of being effective in some regard. Because, you know, while a conservative candidate won't think twice about going for someone's family, we as liberals don't have that same luxury, because then it's not a liberal platform to have. I don't know what the solution is, but that's really what the scenario that has been set up. And it's not surprising that we are where we are today, because as you said, it's incredibly effective.
Well, it's hard to win when you have integrity.
And we have models for it. You look at, say, Elizabeth Warren, and not necessarily what she says, but the way that she says it, and the fact that she sticks to short messages. It's usually about a paragraph. It's easy to understand. You can draw a sentence from it and get the entire meaning. And she's a fighter. That one of my things is, I have a saying where it's, you know, I forgot where I got this from, but when you're in a gunfight, pick up the fucking gun.
Right.
You know, in politics, there's no such thing as playing fair. And so any candidate that runs is going to have to understand that. And any candidate we put forth is going to have to understand that. It's a gunfight. Pick up the fucking gun. It doesn't matter what you did before the gunfight or what's going to happen after the gunfight. The reality is you're in a gunfight. Do something about it.
Absolutely. What were you saying? Go ahead, Ricky.
And so, I mean, if we have candidates with that fighting spirit, then there's not much that we can't do politically.
Very true. What were you saying, Angel?
Oh, I wanted to kind of touch on your point of the GOP and the unions kind of coming together.
Yeah.
That was kind of something I was stressing about earlier in the movement when, you know, when Darren Wilson first killed Mike Brown. And so a couple of weeks later, when we got the response from, like, the KKK, I felt like that should have spoke volumes about what happened that day. Mm. You know what I mean? And so you have a lot of people like, yeah, it was fine. He was just doing his job. But it's like, you have to look at the fact that this officer has the support of the KKK. Like, that's something to really think about.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just kind of to add to the GOP and the union all of a sudden being on the same page. It speaks volumes about what this stance really is.
Yep. Absolutely. Juliet, do you have anything to add on that side of things?
No.
Okay.
Well, I was just saying that it's hard to win when you have integrity.
It's true. It's very true. I think you have to appeal to different things, and I think there's a way to show that the emperor has no clothes on the other side, and that's what we failed at doing. I think that's where the weakness is in our argument. We haven't been proactive enough in that regard in showing that the other side really is not about any of the things they say they're about. They're just about the power and the money. And part of that is keeping people that support them down. And that's really where I think, and I hope that the movement is trying to speak from that place of, let's tell the truth, because if you really knew the truth, there's no way you wouldn't be on our side. That's what I like to think anyways.
Yes and no. I think that most liberals, we know enough to just walk into a room, pick a subject, and make any conservative look like an idiot for the most part, especially the Tea Party types of the Republican base.
Right.
Because everyone knows the emperor has no clothes. But the difference is that this emperor doesn't give a fuck.
Right.
Like, the base of the Republican Party, that racist element, they are essentially the tribe that rubs shit in their hair. They don't care.
Mm-hmm.
The problem lies is with where you start affecting change is when you start attacking the moderates, the establishment Republicans, who at least have some understanding that this is morally inconsistent.
And the establishment Democrats, in many cases, might I also
exactly
add.
Yeah.
Just
yeah,
the establishment, I think, at some level.
Absolutely. And you have to attack the moderates to say, like, why are you allowing this? This is on you.
Yep.
Because that base has no real power without the backing of the Republican brand and party.
It's true.
Right. Go ahead.
No, and I mean, it's one of those things to where, with respect to media spaces, I'm completely against having the crazy conservatives on my show. But I have no problem having a moderate conservative on the show and asking the questions that don't get asked by the mainstream media, which is, you've been wrong for the past six generations about racism. What makes you think you're right this time? And why the fuck are you protecting those crazy sons of bitches? Mm. Honestly.
Yeah.
And make them answer
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
In public, in a public forum.
But they'll never answer. Have you gotten someone to agree to answer that, though, Ricky? For real. I've asked it. I've asked those people on my timeline that are always posting these bullshit, you know, stories that really are from nowhere and don't say anything real and are lying. And I'll say, I just want to know how and what gives you the impression that me fighting for the safety of myself and my people is asking or taking anything away from you. I just want to know. Tell me. Explain it to me, because I want to understand. And it's like fucking crickets.
Yeah, and that's the thing. If you continue to shut them up, because that's been the problem for the longest, is that they've been a loud and vocal majority.
Yeah.
And so if we continue to do those things and ask those questions and shut them up, essentially, it helps. It's not a cure all, but you know it certainly helps. This is a movement that's going to have to be, you know, not either or, but yes and.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's certainly a tool that helps. I've shut up quite a few people, and shutting them up is fine for me. They don't get to come to the table. They don't get to have the grown up discussions.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. What I'd like to see, you talked about your wish list, and I think that there's three things I'd like to see for the next steps moving forward, which is agenda building, both locally and nationally, increased access to authority, which I think is critical in terms of building lasting solutions, and the third is community organization building. And I think that one of the strengths of the movement is, we mentioned before, lots of different organizations have sprung up. But what I see is a lot of organizations whose sole purpose is connecting other people and other organizations with each other. So they're mm-hmm. not the action portion, but they are a bridge and a way of doing some high-level organizing to help people be more effective in their work with each other. And I think it is so different from previous movements, not just the civil rights movement, but many others that we've seen between now and then for lots of other things that have either been successful or not, depending on how you look at it. But I think it's really critical to see, and that's another reason why I say it's leaderful, because when somebody steps up and wants to do something, all they get is support. And it's just amazing to see, and I hope that continues. And it sounds like, from what I'm seeing here and what I'm hearing from people all across the country, that's definitely what's been happening.
I would just quickly just add something to the list, mm-hmm. which is education, like political education to, you know, the young people who maybe don't have a lot of experience organizing, who maybe need more experience with that. That kind of stuff, I think, is going to be really important too.
Well,
yeah, absolutely.
My other thing that's always there, which is funding, I think it's critical.
Oh, yeah.
That's another thing that needs to be. And part of that is a community organization building. I think education falls under there, and certainly financial obligations as well. But I know, Ricky, the last podcast you mentioned, you know, just that liberal causes and causes like this don't get don't get the big bucks because right. there's not a lot of big bucks to be made in it. And I say made in that the interests of the powers that be, which would be corporations that would normally fund us on the other side because it's in their best interest to keep things the way that they are. It's nice to... We need to figure out a way for it to be viable on a financial side of things as well.
Well, maybe we need to hit up some celebrities.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. Tonight there is an event in Los Angeles, actually, and I actually just saw it right before we started filming, and I was looking at who organized it. It's $20 a person to get in. It's a benefit concert. Eric Garner's family is going to be there, and every penny that is get taken from the door is going directly to Mrs. Garner. And I was seeing the names on the list, and it was like Tamar Braxton and who else was on there? Tichina Arnold, a whole host of black celebrities, Tamika Raymond, who was the other one? Cherie Fletcher, who's Will Smith's first wife. A whole host of African-American celebrities that were on the planning committee and also were the hosts of the event. And I was like, I hadn't seen anything like it yet. And I was like, whoa, this is a whole other level of, I guess, intersectionality with the movement and people who I previously referred to as being in the celebrity blackium, which means they don't talk shit about any of these things ever. Ever. Mm-hmm. And now they weren't A-list. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't like, you know, Will Smith himself was there or anything. But I do think it says something that this number of people who clearly run in a specific circle that certainly would have no connection to the day-to-day actions of the movement still thought that they needed to do something. And this is what they could do. so they did it. And so right. hopefully we'll see more of that. You know, we talked last week also about Samuel Jackson's challenge throughout there, and it wasn't much. It wasn't much of a statement, but it was something to say. Hey, I know what's going on. I'm following it. I care about it, and so should you. And I thought that was powerful just to even have that said is something. Yeah. And so, well, hopefully. No, go ahead.
If all the celebrities wearing I can't breathe shirts, you know, pitched in like $1,000, that would go a long way.
Sure would.
Yeah. I thought about asking celebrities for help with my self-care event, mm-hmm. but then I was like, oh, no one knows me on Twitter, so.
Wait, no,
you just need a couple people
a really
to do it. I'm sure you should. I would really do it for
you
sure.
You should, yeah.
Definitely. Sure. Yeah, because even if you don't have, it would get to somebody that would know someone that would be interested, so. Maybe they'll listen to the podcast because we are going to talk about it shortly. I wanted to touch real quickly, or not too quickly, depending on how the conversation goes, about gender equality in the movement and kind of how you've seen that play out locally, how you've seen it played out within, you know, spaces online within the movement, and what your thoughts are. If this is something that has been talked about in meetings that you've seen, is it something conscious? Is it something to do with how millennials approach gender equality? What do you guys think about that?
I think it's been talked about a good amount.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I have to say, like, I don't think I ever really experienced sexism as much as I have lately.
Mm.
Like, in the movement, like, I organized a march at a jail in St. Louis. And this guy showed up to the march with his own megaphone. Like, I had no idea who this guy was.
Oh my goodness.
He was like,
I know who this is.
Yeah, you know this guy.
We got to do better.
I don't know if this is definitely the case. It was pretty bad. Like, it was really hard because it was me and another woman who organized it. And, like, we're both relatively young and, like, we don't have a lot of experience, you know, organizing and things like that and leading a protest. So it was hard to, like, the biggest issues that came up with it were dealing with this guy.
Hmm.
And then, you know, this other guy, and then there's the benevolent sexism where, like, there's this other guy who's like, hey, I have karate friends. Like, we could be your security next time. Oh, be careful. And he, like, drove up and down the street after the protest to make sure we were okay.
Hmm.
And, like, it's nice, but at the same time, it's like, you wouldn't be doing that if this was a man the same age as us who was here. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that was that. So I have definitely experienced that, but I do think that people talk about it, and I think it's out there. So I think that is really good because, you know, oppression within the movement is one of the things that can sort of, I think it's one of the things that can really be a huge problem you know, is when that goes unsaid, when we don't talk about, you know, sexism and different power structures within the movement, I think it's problematic. So I do feel like it's been talked about, but I do think it needs to be discussed more.
Absolutely. Angel, what have you experienced anything? What have you been seeing on that front?
I would have to completely agree. Sexism within the movement has been a bit problematic. One issue that I've experienced is kind of like this silencing of women.
Yeah.
And on one end, I feel like it might be like this subconscious thing. My experience with it has been, you know, just to be in a big group, you know, and just simply trying to speak and just to have, like, all of the men speak over you. You know what I mean? Like, it's like that, you know, and they kind of build up. And then in addition to that, there's some street harassment that goes on in the midst of these protests. And I guess kind of like the situation with a guy, you know, following you in the car. And that, not only is it problematic, but on my end, it's frustrating, and it's almost an irony to it, like as a black woman, to be on the front lines when I'm out there, and to feel like, you know, I literally came out here because a black man died in my city recently. So it's like I'm kind of fighting for your life, but while I'm fighting for you, I also have to fight you.
Yeah.
Because of that sexism that's occurring within the movement. So you know what? We talked about a wish list. That's on my wish list. Let's get to a place where we can talk about all of these isms.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, we can't defeat racism if there's still like this sexism thing going on. You know what I mean? It's going to continue. It's going to continue to be a cycle.
Definitely. I think what Juliet said was that it's being talked about is a huge thing, because it would be very easy to not discuss it at all. And I know that here in Philadelphia, we've definitely had that be a focus in the planning meetings, at least something we talk about. There's actually one of the organizers I work with. His name is Gabe, and he's amazing. He's a fantastic organizer. He works with youth in the city, and he's just really, really great. And he'll say, you know, he helps lead. We usually have at least two women and two men that lead any of the large meetings that we have purposefully. And we also try to have a varied young and, I would say, older, not old, but older contingent as well, so that everyone kind of hears a voice that they can connect with coming from the front of the room. And usually we have him kind of give everyone their marching orders before we break into groups. And he makes this entire piece that he does about making sure that there's no misogyny and that everyone has a chance to speak. And if you see that you're speaking too much, it's time for you to fall back. And then he asks the group, do you all understand what that means? And
that's great.
He wants them to realize, he goes, what I mean by that is that women need to be able to speak, that young people need to be able to speak, that older people need to be able to speak, that this is a space for everybody to speak. And he gives this speech, and I see the guys' faces, because when he asks them, they don't understand what he's talking about at all. Do you understand what I'm talking about? And they don't know. And then he explains what he means, and I see them go, oh, okay, because now they have to go into this breakout session with that. The last thing that he said is in their mind, that they have to keep that in mind when they're going in. So I really encourage anybody that's running any groups, and when you have a lot of people that need to speak, to make sure that you're giving those specific instructions and really bringing to the forefront how important it is to recognize everyone's voice in the group. And we were talking about, you know, the agenda and speeches for the Martin Luther King March that we're having here on January 19th in Philadelphia. And one of the goals we put on our list of what we wanted was an equal amount of men and women speakers.
Mm-hmm.
Not just something that's a wish list, but it's like, nope, we want to get this number of people. And one of the other things we need to make sure we do is that we have equal amount of female and male speakers. So there's a way that we can go about this work and make sure that this is brought to the forefront and that it's in everyone's minds when we're doing the work. And it's really critical that we do that, because women are a huge force, always have been, with regard to civil rights, and certainly on the front lines of this movement, as they are in almost every other one as well.
Yes, and I think that there was like a big discussion a while back about white people and sort of what they're like, how they can best support the movement. And I think we need to have a similar kind of bigger discussion about
you know, sexism in the movement and men and women and LGBTQ representation mm-hmm. and issues and stuff like that. I think the discussion just needs to be bigger.
Yeah. And Ricky, what are your thoughts?
Besides, I'm so sorry.
Besides the apology.
I'm so sorry for all of... Like, honestly, I literally just had this discussion today. And, Leslie, are we clear for sound effects?
You can do some...
There's
so,
a
you
perfect
can,
one right about
yeah, if you, if it come through. Yeah, go ahead. Let's see if
Men,
I can...
Men, we don't know what we did.
I can't put it any clearer.
That's so true.
It's oh, yeah. Oh, gosh, yes, it is very true.
Yeah, because I literally had this discussion, and with some of the people that I was talking to about it, the women, it just seemed to turn them off. And I had to check a friend of mine who is active in the community, a little more personally active than I am, but like I love the guy. He's a good guy at heart. He's misogynist as fuck. Mm. I there's no other way to put it. And I have to check him every once in a while and check him publicly because it's just the things that he says and does aren't right. And I can't in good conscience allow that within a movement where you have so many women that are leaders within the movement. You have you three, of course. You have Netta, Ashley, Alexis. Like, there's so many that there's no need for any of that. You know, if you want to help. If not, you know, if you're trying to control a situation for something you didn't start, you didn't originate, you had nothing to do with the planning of, you shouldn't be there. Mm. Go home.
Right. Yeah.
You're of better use at home.
I think more men need to do that. You know, like call other men out when they're being sexist because a man who's being sexist is not going to listen to a woman saying, look, man, like you need to fall back. But maybe if another man says right. it'll be a little more effective.
Yeah. And that in and of itself
it's
is patriarchy. But I will say, I think
it's
that.
Usually not.
Yeah. But I always think the power is when Gabe says it is that there's this, you know, large, imposing, forceful figure, you know, in our group anyways. But he's very welcoming and comforting and all of that. But when he gives this charge, he's so serious about it and about how sacred he finds the space to be and that it needs to be inclusive. And his conviction on that point and his never wavering from it is really powerful. And I do think it moves the men differently than it would one of us women delivering the same message. And it sucks because it shouldn't be, but... It is what it is. So I do agree with the whole men need to speak up when they see other men acting like assholes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there was one woman in particular, she said that after 25 years of being an activist, she was done. And it was largely because of the sexism that occurs within the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just sexism, like there's also sexual harassment that goes on.
Yep.
And you know, so that's, and actually somebody brought that up at a meeting the other day, like saying, you know, don't sexually harass women when you're at a protest. Like we need to feel comfortable and safe. You know, and so, but that's also a big problem. That's also a problem on top of
the sexism.
You know, no sex.
Yeah. Well, street harassment is everywhere. If there are guys, there will be street harassment. It's not right. It's and more men need to say something, but it's almost a staple. I, you know,
yeah, but I mean,
to be honest, I've used to be a part of it, so I can tell you perfectly that it's, you know, most men don't care. It's they're yeah. always or and perpetually on offense when it comes to dating, and there are times where it's like, no, shut that shit down. This has nothing to do with any of that.
Right.
This is about us. This is about our lives and our livelihood, not about. You know, your dating life.
Right.
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 Yep.
Which there is love in the revolution.
Oh, yes, there is. There's no doubt about
that.
There's
a lot of relationship portion in the movement.
Definitely. It's beautiful.
I'm sure those have evolved organically.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Right. So I know we wanted to transition a little bit here, and these actually do end up being related because we wanted to talk a little bit about mental health in the movement and kind of how that's being fostered or not fostered. I spoke on the first one, about the need for, I was really imploring anyone listening, if you're involved locally, to make sure that you have people that are dedicated to addressing healing and self-care within your movement, because as Ricky mentioned a little bit earlier, this is a long fight that we're in. And part of the sustainability is to make sure that the individuals that are in the fight are ready and able to do that. And part of that has to do with our mental health and self-care. So Angel, talk a little bit with me about kind of, I know this is a something that you've been working on, and also about the event that you have coming up in Ferguson as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Ferguson Self-Care event, which I'm planning for January, it became an idea for me when I had, like, these conversations with other, you know, protesters. And they would be, you know, just completely, like, just everyday conversations, and they would kind of tell me, like, you know, what they're going through. And you have a lot of protesters where relationships have been tarnished sometimes between a boyfriend, girlfriend, family members. You have some protesters that they have been kicked out of homes. You have some protesters due to harassment at their place of employment now have no income. Mm-hmm. And then to add on top of that, you have a situation, you know, these police officers, and I know for me, to see anything cop-related right now is extremely stressful for me. It's extremely triggering for me. I get anxiety. And then you add that on top of what a protest does to your body, especially if you're one of the ones that's been out here since day one. I haven't been a day one protester. I was a week one protester. But it's been hard on my body. You know what I mean? Like, you know, your feet, your back, your neck, you know, especially like when you have people making certain sacrifices. Like for me, I had a transportation issue, so I had to walk to some protest. I'm not the only one that has had to walk to a protest before. And then in addition to that, you have some people that are so dedicated that for whatever reason, there might be times where they're sleeping in tents. So now you have people like regularly sleeping on the ground. You know what I mean? And so all of that kind of builds up. And so that's why the self-care event became important to me, because activist burnout is a real thing. And one thing I noticed, like older people, when they talk about the civil rights movement, There are several reasons why it kind of dwindled off, but one of the reasons was the burnout. And a part of that is because you had the same group of people doing the same stuff every day. And so the burnout happened. And so now here we are in 2014 kind of dealing with the leftover stuff. And so for me, when I look at this movement, I realize, you know what, it's a marathon. It's a marathon, not a sprint. We're in this for the long haul, but the only way we can continue to go is if we sustain ourselves. And so something as simple as making sure I don't get anxiety just because I see a gun on the television, or, you know what I mean, just things like that, like making sure that I know how to de-escalate myself when I'm in the city, when I'm in the protest. I need to know how to de-escalate. You know, if they pull out the rubber bullet guns, if there's tear gas, if there's a flash bomb, whatever may happen, I need to be able to de-escalate. Because when you're dealing with that day in and day out for months at a time, those things can become triggering. They can become harmful. You know what I mean? Like they can evoke a response out of you. And there's no telling how the response or your reaction may go. So that's why the self-care for me is important, because I know we're in this for the long haul.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Juliet, what were your thoughts on that?
I think also when we're talking about things like anxiety or PTSD or whatever, people have stuff that they're bringing with them from before any of this even started. That, you know, that they haven't gotten any kind of help for, anything like that. So there's a lot of things compounding on each other that people are dealing with. And I was thinking about trying to start some support groups with people, like you know, maybe like a women's support group, maybe a mixed one and maybe a men's or something like that. Just some way for people to get together and where the whole point of the meeting is just to talk about how people are feeling, you know, offer resources that people know about and things like that. Because I just don't think a lot of that is happening far. Maybe in smaller groups, like with friends, but not sort of on a bigger level. And
yeah.
I know the Association for Black Psychologists in St. Louis, I don't know if they're doing this in other cities, but they now and then have some like therapy groups, some free therapy groups for people that I'm going to try and help them like more widely publicize that. But I'm really excited for your event, Angel. And I think it's going to be great. And I think one of the other things that happens is sometimes people kind of romanticize not taking care of ourselves. So like, I remember I saw a post on Twitter that was like, you're not a real revolutionary if like you've gotten more than 3 hours of sleep or something like that. And I want us to really focus on saying like, you know, that's great, but what's really revolutionary is taking care of yourself. You
absolutely
know what I mean?
That's really the counterculture thing to do, because we don't actually do it in regular life, much less in the work, in this particular work. So it's that would be
and like Angel was saying, you know, when you take care of yourself, you're able to sustain your momentum much better. And so it's crucial to the movement that we take care of ourselves. And you know, so I think, and you know, I have a mental health background, and I think anybody in their own city or town who has that kind of background, I mean, even if you don't have that kind of background, but especially those who do have that background, it's sort of their responsibility in a way to make sure that they're checking in about those kinds of resources and those kinds of events and groups and stuff for people who are really, for people who are in the movement.
And I think it's a great way to get other people involved in the movement as well, that maybe they don't see protesting as something that calls to them or being involved in any legislative action or anything like that, but they know how to help people. And so if you can help support people in the movement, that can be a really, not can be, it is a really important role on all levels, including in terms of supporting self-care. I did want to just mention that if you'd like to donate supplies or volunteer or make a donation of space or food for the Ferguson Self-Care Day, you can go to liberatedsouls.wordpress.com, and there's a link to an Amazon wish list, as well as a way to give monetary donations, and also a form to donate your time or any other donation you'd like to make. And we really encourage people to do that. And I'll have that link on the show notes as well. Ricky, what are your thoughts? I know that you have a lot of thoughts about mental health in general, but how do you see it kind of playing a role in keeping this movement going?
Well, Juliet gave a great example of people who had pre-existing issues before this movement started. And I mean, in all honesty, I'm one of them. I actually had to take off work last month for a couple of weeks because the everything just compounded. Mm-hmm. And so like, I was like literally in therapy 4 days a week, because sometimes you don't know when you're going to break.
Yep.
And, you know, people have internalized that type of behavior that Juliet was referring to, as far as like, I'm grateful if I get more than 5 hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. And I know in the back of my mind that that's not normal, but it's what I've been used to and I've operated on for so long that I don't care.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are like that, because it's already something that in our 24-hour culture we're used to, mm-hmm. we're accustomed to doing.
Right.
And so I definitely understand that the risk of activist burnout being a lot higher than it was, say, in the 1950s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, it's not just the movement. It's the things that have caused the movement.
Mm.
Right.
The fact that I've been pulled over for stealing my own car, to the point where the first thing the cop does when he walks up is, can you unlock your door? Wait, hold on. What happened to license and registration?
Right.
You know, those types of things, the things that where anytime I'm pulled over, my hands are literally shaking and I have to light a cigarette to even remain remotely calm.
Mm.
You know, those are things that we were dealing with before. And I've said this before, Mike Brown's death was literally the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yep.
You know, it wasn't Eric Garner. Eric Garner prove to be, we end up going back to look at Eric Garner because a lot of the circumstances around Garner's death were a lot more concrete than Mike's death.
And I think that
because it was on video.
Yeah, and I think that it came to where, obviously, as you said, Mike Brown's death was definitely the straw that broke the camel's back for those of us that are in the movement. But the people that push back on us making our stand there, all of their arguments fall apart when Eric Garner is brought to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, to me, that's the significance of this kind of, I don't like to call it a 1-2 punch, but I do think that there's a, okay, one death galvanized us, and the other was like, yeah, everything you said that we were talking and you tried to act like we were crazy, well, what the fuck do you say to this then? That it's on video,
right.
That this is illegal,
yeah.
That it was declared a homicide, and still nothing was done. Now what do you have to say? Because
right.
Anything
and,
you say
you
after now is racist.
The same way.
Absolutely. And Tamir, Anakai, all of this. They've each gone to illustrate every time they have something to say, oh, but it was this. Well, how many excuses are you going to have for unarmed
right.
black people to just be killed
yeah.
indiscriminately
right.
with no consequences? How many excuses can you really give? All of them fall apart with each of these cases. And it's just crazy. And it's a really great point you make, Ricky, about you don't know when you're going to break. I'm not going to play it here because I find it so disturbing, but there was a videotape that came out today, of course, from TMZ, the bastion of investigative journalism in 2014, lamentably.
For real.
Literally. I'm not even joking. I really wish I was, but they are the 2014 Woodward and Bernstein, sad to say, today of Great Elk Lodge in Glenside, California, former Sundown Town in California, that changed the lyrics to Bad, Bad Leroy Brown to Dead, Dead Michael Brown.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't even.
I didn't want to bring that up.
I couldn't even.
I'm not going to talk anything about the specifics of it. But there were police officers there, and I made the mistake of watching it, and it literally broke me. I had to leave the room. I was in tears. It just. It is heinous. I've seen heinous things before, but it was something about that to me personally, just in the wake of being told that we shouldn't protest and give people space to grieve, and then this is how we are able to grieve. Really? Not at all. And it was just so egregious and so hateful. It broke me. I was really like, I have to leave the room. I need to take some time and go. I don't know. I just had to take some time. I had to step away. And so it's true. You never know when that break is going to come, and it's really important to start to train ourselves to see when that happens and what our reaction is going to be to that, and make that a conversation that is not only not seen as negative in the movement, but one that we welcome people talking about.
Right.
It's really going to be critical for sustainability, because you don't want people to be ashamed of their breakdowns. It's just something that's going to happen. It's difficult work, and the things that we confront every day, it's difficult. There's a physical nature to protesting, but there's also an emotional and mental one where, you know, it's not fun to be shouting for 7 hours. It's not fun to be in coming up against a row of police officers with such hatred on their face you can't even imagine. It's not great to be, you know, just chanting Black Lives Matter, and you can hear, even though they didn't say it, you can just see the N-word form in someone's mind from their from behind their seat in their car, because they're inconvenienced and are going to be late getting home. I mean, there's no preparing for those emotions that come up when those things happen, and so it's really critical that we talk about them. One other thing I wanted to mention, because I know it's been on a lot of people's minds in the movement, particularly, well, actually, I think everybody, but I know it's something that a lot of white people that are involved in the movement are dealing with right now, which is being around friends and family that are very anti the movement and are kind of speaking from a completely different place than we're all coming from, and kind of how you find a space in those moments with your family, and kind of how you navigate that. Have you guys experienced any of that, or have you talked to anybody that's been experiencing it? Obviously, I think when we're online and dealing with people, it's one thing, but this time of year often brings those people into our physical space and can cause some additional stresses.
Yeah, I have a friend who experienced a lot of that over Thanksgiving. She's white, and her family is all, they all grew up like sort of in rural Missouri. And, you know, they're pretty much racist. Well, they are racist. And so she was dealing with that a lot. And I know it was stressful for her. But I think for her, what maybe helped was just recognizing, or was kind of being solid and confident in her, in what she believes in. Mm-hmm. And I think that can somewhat help, like, not take things personally or get too upset. And I think also sometimes, like, depending on the person, sometimes if the issue comes up, you just have to say, like, I can't talk. I'm not talking about this. I can't, you know, because you don't want to get into, if you're not going to be changing anyone's mind, you know, it's great. Like, it's great if somebody is open and you can sort of educate them. I think that's the best case scenario. But if you know that somebody is just, you know, grandma's like 97, she's been racist her whole life, and it's like she's not changing her mind, then you might have to just move on.
Mm.
Yeah. I would have to agree with that. Like, just knowing when is the time to have the conversation, mm-hmm. and when it isn't. And sometimes, mm-hmm. I like engage in all conversations where you clearly cannot change someone's mind. You just have to walk away and say, you know what, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And on my end, yeah. I have a family member who is actually out of state. She's in Illinois, right? Chicago, Illinois? Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's very, like, anti the protest. But part of the reason why is because her perception is based on what she sees in the media a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a lot of times our encounters is me saying, no, this is what happened. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I would have to show her this other side of the story.
Right.
And then in addition to that, you also have a lot of people, they don't know, like, everything that we do. So, like, a lot of people see the protest, and so you get a lot of people like, okay, yeah, y'all protesting, you know, so now what? But they don't realize, like, no, we have people going to the council meetings.
Yep.
We have, we're trying to develop legislative plans. We're trying to develop economic plans. You know what I mean?
Right.
But see, that's not the sexy stuff that they're going to show you on TV.
Right.
And so sometimes you get people that are anti the movement because they feel like, oh, well, this is just a bunch of people saying it was fine. They won't do anything. And so my response to that is just simply to show the other side, to provide other information, and that has been very successful for me.
Hmm.
Unless it's, you know, like the example, you know, grandma has been racist for 97 years, you know, that would be the only time that doesn't work.
Doesn't work, yeah, it doesn't work too good. What are your thoughts on that, on this topic, Ricky?
Surprisingly, I'm probably going to have to deal with this come Christmas, but I don't care. I'm combative, so I don't really
care. He'll fight the 97-year-old. He'll fight the 97-year-old if he has to.
Yeah.
We young. I mean, we strong. We are.
When it comes to these types of things, I'm a fighter, so it doesn't really bother me. I mean, I get kind of maybe carried away, but I have no problem breaking anyone down point by point, line by line, word by word. In their face, online. And so I'm probably going to have to do it to one of my younger brothers. There's probably an uncle or two I'm going to have to do it for. And then the other thing, too, is it goes back to how often people actually watch the news.
Mm.
Two-thirds of this country only watch the news for either 10 or 12 minutes.
Right.
Or, I'm sorry, 10 or 2 minutes a day.
Yeah, for the weather.
What can you gather
right, that's to get
them,
the weather.
Other than the weather? Yeah, I mean, what can you possibly gather from that about the movement and how widespread it is and how the amount of depth that accompanies it. You
yeah.
can't. I on average listen to maybe about 2.5, anywhere from 2 to 4 hours of news a day. Mm-hmm. I can't keep up. So, I get it and I understand, but, you know, a lot of my time is spent re-educating people. So I've this year I can finally save some time. Like, yo, you know what? Go listen to my podcast. Like, I don't
right.
even have to do
yeah.
this anymore.
Like, here, I've done it for you. Listen.
Exactly.
Listen, Linda.
I get tired of having the same conversations over and over and over from with the same type of uninformed person. And it's probably by no fault of their own. A lot of people have become apathetic and just have given up. But you know, you can't just sit there and make assumptions if you're giving up and you're not paying attention.
Right.
If you don't care, then shut the hell up.
Right.
Yeah.
All together. Right.
Absolutely. One thing I say, and I do say I encourage this because it was something I was a little hesitant about before Thanksgiving when my whole family comes to our house here for holidays. And I didn't know if we were going to talk about the movement. I didn't know if I wanted to, if I was trying to create a space for myself to kind of take a bit of a mental break and some self-care. But we had an opportunity to talk about it because over Thanksgiving, there was the Stolen Lives initiative where people were taking pictures of empty seats at their Thanksgiving Day tables. So we did that at our Thanksgiving table. My sisters, my nieces, and my mom and I sat around a table, and we had an empty chair at the head of the table. And Drew took the picture. And that kind of sparked really big conversation at the table. It was really emotional and raw. And I have a 15-year-old niece, and she felt she really was, you know, kind of interested in it. And my other nieces kind of, they got it. And I was surprised at how cathartic it was for me to have, like, oh, I can talk about this. And it's not, you know, ugly, and it's not from a place of defensiveness, because it's my family and they love me and they would support whatever I'm doing. And so I would encourage people, if you see your family is receptive to talking about it, or even just pockets of it, give yourself that space to have a comforting, cushiony space of people to listen to what you're doing and support you in that love you, because it goes a long way to that self-care angle of things as well. Even if you can't convince a racist 97-year-old. Maybe your cousin Brad will listen to you in earnest while you guys are, you know, doing the dishes or something. So look for those moments as well, because they can certainly help in navigating that. I want to do a quick organization spotlight, and I want to spotlight the Operation Help or Hush, and you can find them at operationhelporhush.org. Yes. reading from their website, which is Taking Social Media Activism to the Street, they're a new spin on an old school organizing, and they grew organically on Twitter in the midst of events occurring in Ferguson, Missouri, following the death of Mike Brown. And Twitter activists are responsible for the incredible coverage and attention in Ferguson and have shown the power and potential of social media to make an impact. So they have funding priorities. Priority one is organizing organizers, which we were talking about earlier. So that's effective community organizing requires infrastructure and supplies to endure. So they buy supplies for making signs, covering travel expenses, ensure organizers have food and shelter, and develop systems to link organizers together. And so I know that they are finishing up right now, putting together a 4-bedroom dwelling that they can have protesters staying in. Priority number two. It's sustaining protesters, because protesting is a high energy activity, which we also discussed about. So they talk about keeping protesters fed and hydrated and covering costs and related technical assistance. And then priority number three is resourcing the community. And so communities are in crisis, and that's why they organize. So they link other community partners to pool and leverage resources for maximum impact, which is, again, this is one of those organizations that have sprung up to support the movement and those doing this work and connect them together. So it's really critical. And you can go to their webpage again, operationhelporhush.org, and donate directly there. They're doing some amazing work. And yeah, so that's our organizational spotlight for this week. As we go to the end of the hour, I do just want to, or not hours, like a couple hours now, actually. End of the show. Just mention also, if you were looking to do some last minute donation gifts, which means you could donate in someone's name and give them a little gift. Again, you can go to liberatedsouls.wordpress.com to donate to the Ferguson Self-Care Day that Angel is organizing in January. You can also, there'll be a link on my website to support Netta and DeRay and their efforts in Ferguson and also elsewhere in the country. They've been able to travel and also to support the newsletter that they put out. They had a new issue come out today, which is great. And I also would mention the Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment. They have a bail fund donations, and I'll have that link on there as well to help donate for any organizers in the area there that are incarcerated, so that we can get them out quickly. And yep. Also, glossrags.com, which sells the And Counting t-shirts. So you guys can take a look at that. And all these links will be on the show notes on the website. So let's do a quick round. And if anybody has some final thoughts on any of the subjects we talked about today or any thoughts you want to give regarding the movement going into this last week of the year. And we'll start with Angel.
Well, my only thought is thank you so much for a podcast. I feel like out of every avenue we pursued for communication, this is the one that no one has covered yet, at least to my knowledge. And so I just thank you for providing this for people that may be, you know, more vocal. Not everyone wants to tweet. Not everyone wants to, you know, write something. Not everyone wants to be behind the camera. And so I really appreciate this new avenue for us to express ourselves in the movement.
Awesome. Absolutely. And thanks for being here. Julia, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with Angel. I love all your podcasts, but it's awesome that you have one focused specifically on the movement. And, you know, in that vein, like, I think I want to encourage people all over the place to start thinking about how can we create alternative systems in our communities. So, like, having a podcast like this is an example of, like, alternative media. And you know, how can we have alternative sort of education systems? Not to say that kids aren't going to go to school, but how can we sort of try to empower our communities as much as possible? I feel like that is really, like, an important next step in this movement. And so I hope that people really start getting on that quickly. And thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
Awesome. Ricky.
Yes, ma'am. No, thank you for having me on. I wanted to say on behalf of the LAPD video and the song, I personally apologize as an LA resident and native, because to me it came as no surprise.
Right.
And so right. I had enough sense not to watch it because I know just how terrible they can be. There are lots of good officers within the LAPD, but there are also some really, it's a terrible culture. Mm. And so even the good officers don't speak up.
Right.
I have distant family members who are officers, and a lot of times they don't have a job. Mm. They say anything. If they do the right thing.
Yeah.
As for Juliet and Angel, you guys are more than welcome on my podcast anytime. I've had Larry and Ashley on the show before. So, I mean, awesome. People have kind of reached out. I know Elon James Wyatt has had quite a few people on. He's had Netta on. Those types of independent media sources are what are going to be able to accurately frame things, because you've seen a lot in the mainstream media, even when they are going up on, we do make it up on stage or up on the camera, it's being framed in a terrible way. The DC protest being, or the, I'm sorry, the Baltimore protest being a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, if you guys have at any point in time, feel free to reach out. I may actually want to reach out to you guys about, or to Angel about the, no, I'm sorry, Juliet, you're the one doing the self-help one, right? The self-care?
That's Angel, yeah.
Well, Angel's doing,
I'm sorry. I'm terrible with names anyway. So the fact that I remembered both of your names is amazing to me thus far. But if you want to get together, we're more than welcome to we have like a standalone segment that we do for specific activists, and there's a way to get, it's basically an ad for you.
He's great at it, too. It's great.
Cool. Yeah. It's essentially a 30 to 45 minute ad where we just kind of talk things out and get people to understand where you guys are coming from and what the thought process is behind that particular movement or piece of activism or policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to do that.
Awesome. Right. I love connecting awesome people. Yay.
Yeah. Right, and I'd love to be on whenever the next person.
Yeah.
Great.
Awesome.
I'll definitely reach out to you both.
And for me, I'm going to just read a couple of words. Actually, these are highlights from the message delivered by Reverend Michael Waldron at the Silent Night Candlelight Vigil organized by New York Justice last week. he says quite a few of these things. So all of these things came from his address. He says, "Do not grow weary in this work. Do not grow tired in this work. No longer can your pain be ignored. No longer can our pain be compromised. We are committed to movement building. This moment right now calls for something deeper, something that we feel, that we've been sensing, that we've been feeling all along. Every day you wake up with justice on your mind. You are part of the echoes of the ancestors who are depending on your vitality to push the movement forward. Don't ever feel, one, that you are alone, two, that this is new, but three, know this, that those who came before you experienced victory. Don't let anyone tell you that this work will not come to fruition. This country needs you. This world needs you. We need you. Be vigilant, courageous, and forthright. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week."